today is the first podcast in a series to shine a spotlight on health tech innovation. We will be exploring why the NHS needs innovation, how universities play a critical role in nurturing innovation, as well as discussing challenges that innovators experience. We will hear from two guests who have a background in education and research, are innovators, and has an innovation that aims to address loneliness for senior citizens. Today, we are joined by Professor Dean McMillan. Dean designs effective and scalable behavioural interventions. He read psychology at Cambridge before completing his PhD in population science. Simon Gilbody is an epidemiologist with training in medical psychology and cognitive behaviour therapy. He's a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences and one of the top 1% of scientists in the world. Simon remains a practical NHS clinician and led the clinical trials of their third age therapeutics. Dear Simon and Dean, welcome to the Propel podcast. Let's get into it.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you.
We feel very honoured to be here for the first podcast, and we've been coaching you to try and get you to pronounce epidemiologist.
Epidemiologist.
There you go. You got it.
10 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah. I'm getting there. No, it's really good to have you guys on the first Propel podcast. So the first section is getting to know your guests. So Simon, you're a professor, a scientist, an innovator, and a founder. So that is impressive. Like, they're big things just doing one of them. How do you juggle those big areas at the moment?
Wow, that's a great question, Tim. So, I mean, the first thing is, when you say that, it sounds like I do all of those things at the same time. But no, this is a career and it's a process of evolution. And someone said to me a good few years ago, it might have been my late great Nana. She said, if you find a job that you like, you'll never work another day in your life. So that's been that for me. So when I found something I like, that was science and medicine. Those things are what I've done for the last 30 years, and it's been an absolute joy. And when you do that, you build things and you innovate. And we've been on a journey to innovate and try and solve important problems. And we can talk about one of those problems today, how we improve the mental health of older people and address the epidemic of loneliness. But in order to make a difference and to innovate, you have to make things happen at scale. So a founder is something that I've done relatively recently, and it's been an absolute joy, and that's been the latest thing that I do. Find a job you like and you'll never work a day in your life. So that's me.
And did you start with your academic studies first, your research, and how did you get to innovation?
So I got to innovation by
accident.
Sort of by accident. No, there's been no great plan. So the first thing is I was kidnapped and taken across the border from another place, the other side of the Pennines. So I was kidnapped and taken to Yorkshire about 30 years ago. So I came to medical school here in Yorkshire. So I trained to be a doctor in the first instance at the University of Leeds Medical School. And I also did some additional training in psychology. So that was the basis on which all the things that I've done have been founded. So that very solid clinical training that you get that at medical school, and also working in the NHS. So I've been man and boy in the NHS. So I still practice in the NHS as a senior doctor, and that's great. So that's the foundation for everything that we do. But then on top of that, it's great working as a doctor, but you often become curious about the why questions and the how questions. So I did some additional training as a scientist. So like lots of people that you'll meet that are innovators, they've also trained as scientists. So I've got a PhD, and I did that at the University of York. And I trained in epidemiology, so trying to understand problems and disorders and diseases, not at the individual level, but at the population level. This is a very useful perspective for thinking about how we tackle the big questions, particularly in the NHS. But I also trained in health economics, so trying to understand how we create things that are of value and that are cost effective and that generate return on investment for the NHS and broader society. So those are the foundations of what I've done. So firstly, a clinician, still a practicing clinician, but also a scientist. And it's that combination of things that gets me out of bed these days.
How did you get into innovation?
So we build things. So we do large programs of research. So we push forward the science bit by bit. And sometimes you discover something that's really important and is of value. And as scientists, usually what we do is we move on to the next research question, or we apply for the next research grant. And Dean and I will talk to this. We think we discovered something really important about how you can improve the mental health of older people. And instead of moving on to the next trial, we thought, well, we want to make this happen at scale. We want to see the research that we do actually make a difference in the real world. So our innovation and our pathway to creating a university spin out and joining the Propel program was born out of not wanting to do more research, but to generate impact from that research. So that's how we got here. So you've got to have done the research in order to innovate and to create traction and impact from the work that you do. So this is how we got here. So it's the end of a long journey and the beginning of a new one as innovators.
Yeah, that's interesting. The jump you made between clinical, academic, and innovation. Because a lot of times, you know, clinicians will see the problem and then they'll want to resolve it. So, Dean, you're the co-founder, is that correct?
That's it, yeah.
At Third Age Therapeutics. So, Third Age Therapeutics is your organization, your innovation?
Yeah, it's our spin out from the university, and it focuses on, as you were saying, how do we help people who are older adults reduce the levels of loneliness, reduce other things as well, such as depression, improve anxiety levels and things like that.
Okay. And Dean, did you follow a similar route as Simon in terms of, are you a clinician?
Yeah, so I'm a clinical psychologist by background. So Simon's a psychiatrist, I'm a clinical psychologist. So we've got, you know, similar clinical backgrounds. And like Simon, I also did a PhD, so I'm an academic as well as a clinician. And again, like Simon, got to a point in my career where I thought, well, we've done lots of lovely research for 20 years, but we want to see a difference in the real world. And rather than just move on to the next trial, the next bit of research, take a bit of a pause and think, well, if we want to make a difference in the real world, perhaps developing a spin out and doing it ourselves is the way to make that difference in the real world.
And how did you get to know Simon, Dean?
So we've known each other for quite a while now, probably 20 years. We both worked over at the University of Leeds at some point. Simon jumped ship to York and he said, do you want to jump ship as well? And I couldn't jump fast enough. And the rest is history.
Well, it's a beautiful city, isn't it, York?
Yeah, yeah. A gorgeous city.
Why would you not?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll move on to talking about your organisation, your commercial organisation, Third Age Therapeutics. So, Simon, tell us, what is Third Age Therapeutics? Is it a product? Is it a service? Give us a flavour of what it actually is.
So I'll start with the name, and there's a clue in the name there. So it's about the third age, and the third age of our life is the time that we have after we retire. So our golden years, and these should be our best years. So so we've embedded that in the name of our spin out, and we're deeply bothered about the mental health of older people. And unfortunately, mental ill health, problems like worry, depression, anxiety, and loneliness, they work against your third age, your golden years being not as good as they might be. So we want our retirement years to be our best years. Dean and I are fast approaching our retirement years.
I feel like I am.
Yeah, so we've got skin in the game. Yeah. And we've also got aging parents. So this is quite personal for us. So we wanted to change the story a bit. We wanted to ensure that older people get good access to very effective psychological care. So we've developed a service to promote the well-being of older people, the psychological well-being as well as their physical well-being. But at the heart of that is this deeply evidenced product that emerges from the research program that we've been undertaking for 20, 30 years. So at the heart of our spin-out is something we call telephone-first psychological care. And the good thing about that is it democratizes evidence-based psychological care to promote healthy aging. So that's what we're about, healthy aging, golden years, and making sure our third age, the years in our third age, are our best years.
Yeah, it's interesting the link between your research and the innovation. Again, I suppose it's going back to the point of where you see a problem, but you've also come up with a solution, a service that supports that area. So the concept of it came from the COVID pandemic, is that correct?
That's right.
It is.
So did you get a sense that you was sort of ahead of the curve because you was researching this area and then, you know, the COVID pandemic appeared?
Yeah, well, the COVID pandemic, I mean, where are we now? We're 2026. So we're 6 years on from what happened in early 2020. And like lots of people, we sort of saw this coming, but we were taken by surprise by the massive impact it had on society. So we like to call the COVID pandemic a black swan event. It happens once in a generation. And we wanted to see how the work that we've been doing over the years, over the decades, might be useful in helping the NHS and the research community respond to this pandemic. So we've been doing this for three decades. And when a black swan event comes along, we knew about the pandemic and we had a strong sense of what the impacts might be on the psychological health of the population, particularly for older people. So we knew that social isolation, people staying locked up in their homes, away from their loved ones, often quite isolated, was going to be supremely bad for both their physical health, it accelerates frailty, but it was also going to be very bad for their mental health. It was going to substantially increase rates of depression and anxiety. And the big driver of this was loneliness. And we thought, well, we've been doing this for three decades. We're well placed to try and help society and the NHS respond to this. So we wanted to change the way things happen in response to the pandemic. And we sort of knew what to do. So we took the things that we've honed over the years, over the decades, these evidence-based approaches to psychological health. And we thought about how we could adapt those to try and respond to this problem of social isolation and loneliness. So we devised and we innovated. And the great thing about the NHS during the pandemic is it showed it what it can do in the face of, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime event. So the NHS went onto a war footing and they were very interested in research and innovation. So just as the people down in Oxford were very well placed to respond to creating a vaccine at scale and at speed, we were well placed to respond to the psychological needs of the population. And it was important that we tested out what we developed to demonstrate that it worked and that it was cost effective. So we were able, under pandemic conditions, to design an intervention, but then go on to test it in what came to be the largest ever clinical trial of a psychological intervention to help older people deal with social isolation, to try and promote their mental health and prevent the onset of things like depression or anxiety. So that's what we did during the pandemic. We innovated, but we also evaluated. And we're also quite proud of the NHS. So the trial that we did and the team that helped us deliver it, it was actually signed off by Professor Chris Whitty. So this was something that the NHS wouldn't have been able to do at other times during the pandemic. So we were able to harness the pandemic to make an advance in the science. So when we get to the end of the pandemic, we know something that we didn't know before the pandemic. We know how to maintain and improve the mental health of older people at scale using this approach that we've developed. So we wanted to try and ensure that that was brought to scale and that this was implemented. And this is what we do on the Propel program.
So that's interesting that the COVID pandemic, if there was going to be any positives that came out of it, it seems like what you're saying, Simon, was there was it drove the appetite for innovation, which sometimes can be a barrier in the NHS. For whatever reason. Okay, Dean, so how does it aim to help? So you've mentioned loneliness, mental health. What does it actually do? How does it support patients with that?
So the idea is that we help people make quite small changes to behaviour sometimes, but we know that by making key changes, you can have quite a big impact down the line if you keep doing those. So we focus on spotting some behaviours where we might encourage a person to do a bit more of those behaviours, that'd be meaningful, important behaviours, but we might also help people spot other behaviours they might want to reduce a bit. So those are behaviours such as putting things off, doing stuff tomorrow, which might work for you in the short term, but in the long term are stopping you doing those important or meaningful behaviours. So it's doing some more of some behaviours, a bit less of other behaviours, and then just experimenting long enough to see what impact that has on things like loneliness, depression and anxiety. And it's, as Simon was saying, we've got a really solid evidence base through a very big randomised trial that these small changes can have a big, profound impact on people.
And does the citizens' relatives get involved with that? Is there an element of community with that?
Yeah, so certainly there could be carers that might get involved, or other family members might help the person make those changes or support those changes. So often, yeah, there will be that type of family element to to get this stuff working.
And you've mentioned loneliness. So what's the impact on the elderly with loneliness?
Well, it's really profound. So loneliness affects about 1 million older adults in the UK. So about 1 million older adults will report feelings, frequent feelings of loneliness. And we know it's really bad for you. So we know, as Simon was mentioning, it's really bad for your mental health. So it increases the risk of depression, it increases the risk of anxiety. It can increase cognitive decline as we get older. But what people perhaps don't know as much is it's really bad for your physical health as well. So there's some really solid epidemiology suggesting that being lonely as an older adult is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So 1 5 cigarettes a day. And that's because of its impact on stroke, risk for stroke, risk for other heart problems.
So that's the impact. You're a clinical psychologist. How has that informed you developing the product?
Well, I guess the key way is psychologists or clinical psychologists are always concerned about making sure you've got the right theory, the right psychological theory underpinning an intervention. So you don't just intervene, you've got a psychological theory to help you understand what's going on. And we've used a theory that's really old. It's been around a long time, 50, 60 years. It's called operant conditioning. It's in and out of fashion, but it's never out of style. And it's never out of style because it works. It's quite a simple model, but it gives you a really good bang for your buck. So we can make some quite simple changes to behaviour and see some quite important changes in mood down the line if you make those changes. So we've gone for that theory because it's simple. Another reason we like it is that means we can train up people who aren't clinical psychologists or psychiatrists to deliver it. And one of the things that gets me out of bed is the idea we've known for 50, 60 years we've got psychological treatments that work, but very few people get them in the UK or worldwide. And that's because typically you need a highly trained therapist to deliver them. So we've spent quite a lot of time thinking, well, if we want to have an intervention that's going to make a difference, it's got to be something that can be delivered by people who aren't CBT therapists, clinical psychologists or psychiatrists. And we think through our work, we've done that.
And it sounds like you're utilising, there's the nudge theory, like giving people nudges to make changes.
Yeah, so that comes from behavioral economics, which should sit very, very happily alongside the approach we take. Yeah.
And Simon, in the age today where we've all got connected devices and we've got Zoom and what have you, do you find it strange how we still have loneliness? Do you think technology, although it connects people, it can isolate people?
Yeah, so connection's a double-edged sword, and the way in which we interact as humans is going through a profound and historic shift just at the moment. So loneliness has been around as long as humans have spoken to each other. And but the thing that I'm always struck by is that you can be in a crowd but still very lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Most people will relate to that. You walk into a room full of strangers and these are not immediately your friends. So there's something about the quality of the relationships that you have. And I think digital connection adds an additional layer to that. And digital isolation's a thing. You can have lots of very poor quality contacts through digital connection. And it also can sometimes squeeze out those meaningful human connections that we make, and often those are face-to-face, in-person interactions. Or, as we've shown, you can actually reproduce a lot of in-person interactions via some older technology, still digital technology, and that's the old-fashioned phone, so getting people to talk to each other. And we're particularly interested in older people, and older people, lots of older people, ourselves included, are very digitally switched on and connected. But that's not universally true. So a lot of older people feel quite excluded from the digital revolution. So we often talk about the digital divide. And the digital divide is something that impacts lots and lots of people, but it disproportionately impacts on older people. That might be not feeling comfortable with digital devices. It might be that you've not got great digital connections. It costs quite a lot of money to be digitally connected. So digital isolation and loneliness is a thing right across society, but we would say it disproportionately impacts on older people. So we've got to find a way of addressing that. And we think telephone first, ways in which we can help people connect, doesn't squeeze digital out, but it can help fill the gaps left by this digital divide and digital loneliness.
Yeah, and health inequalities is a big agenda for the NHS, especially with the adoption of technology, not leaving anyone behind. So at the end of this, we've got a patient, a citizen that's getting value from your product. Have you got any stories of how your product, your services supporting the elderly in this area?
Well, shall I go first with one? Yeah. One of the great things about working during the pandemic is that we were able to draw upon the wisdom of the crowd. And the crowd that we had was a group of older people who were what we call experts by experience, often people with who were socially isolated, many of whom had got long-term health problems, many of whom were also carers. So they helped us build this intervention. So it's what we call co-produced. And the important thing about co-production is that you're not the only experts in the room, and people's own lived experience is really important. So they told us what the nature of loneliness was, particularly from the perspective of an older person, particularly from the perspective of a carer. And during the pandemic, lots of people helped us stay in contact. So we had lots of online meetings with older people who were experts by experience. And they got a lot out of this during the pandemic. So it was very good for their mental health, helping us build this program. And co-production, you know, the people who help you build this, they're your harshest critics, but they're also your strongest advocates and your best friends. So they told us individually how important this intervention was. So lots of people told us who participated in the trial as well that this was life-changing. It kept them alive and it kept them sane during the pandemic. And could they get it even though the pandemic had finished? Or could they recommend it to their friends? So we've got lots of individual stories of where this was very powerful. And we like to say it passed the friends and family test. So if this be around during the pandemic, I don't mean it's my dad who was impacted by the pandemic. I think Dean would probably say the same. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Dean?
Yeah, well, I guess the other thing we do when we do the research on this is we don't just count the numbers and we don't just bean count. We ask people how they found the intervention. It's called qualitative research. So there's some really moving quotes from the qualitative research we did suggesting that, yeah, this was, you know, an absolute lifesaver during the pandemic for some people. It really made a difference. It allowed them to make some changes, get reconnected again, and actually get through the pandemic in a way they'd have really struggled, they'd say, without the intervention. And reading those quotes, it's genuinely moving, and it makes you realise, yeah, that's why you do the job. It's not just the bean counting. It's not just getting grey hairs from trying to run a big trial. It's it makes a difference down at the end.
Yeah. And I guess there's something really rewarding, feeling like you're making a positive impact on people's lives.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just research for research's sake. So we wanted to do research that has an impact. And stories as well as numbers are really important. And it's personal for us. We are at that stage where we've got older parents as well as families that we care for. And trying to work out how best we can devise things that will be helpful for our parents and the friends of our parents was really important for us during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And that was true for lots of people in the team as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you bridge the gap between your academic work, your research, and then you're creating a commercial organisation? You know, building technology is not the cheapest thing to do.
Sure, yeah.
And that's just one element of it. How did you move that forward?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a great question, Tim. One of the things that I've noticed is that you evolve as you pass through life, and you often find that the things that you've learned in the past that are useful for things that you're going to do in the future, and those are sometimes called transferable skills. So, you know, I built stuff. So I built a team at a university. I've built large multi-centre research programs, and I've been out and secured the grants to enable us to do that research. So I found that there've been quite a few transferable skills from that. So those of us who work in research would recognise that we're hunter-gatherers, so we've got to go out and get the money in order to do the research that we do. Otherwise, you can't do it at scale. So that was really useful. You know, we go out and we try to seek money and investment to support the rollout of our innovation. So that's a great transferable skill. There's something about tenacity as well. So when you apply for a grant, there's only about a 20% hit rate. So 80% of the time you're going to be unsuccessful. So if you can't cope with rejection, you're in the wrong job. And I think that's really important in innovation. So you're going to get far more rejections than you're going to get acceptances and successes. So you've got to be able to deal with that and to be able to learn with it. There's something about large, complex studies, delivering studies across many, many sites in the NHS and making sure that those happen to time and to target and within budget. So there's something about being an accountant, a project manager when you're a research leader. So I think those are really useful and transferable when it comes to innovation. And there's something about building and leading teams. So in order to deliver a project, you've got to find people with complementary skills, bring them together. And the leadership thing is getting people to jump together. And I find that's really useful in innovation as well. And there's something about, you know, being able to build new relationships and being able to continually make contacts. And the great thing about innovation is you get to hang out with different people. I'm going to say maybe get to hang out with cooler people.
Slightly cooler, absolutely, yeah.
You're good self-tip. Yeah.
Which has been a really, really interesting part of it. You know, you realise there are transferable skills, but you're in a completely different world. And there's something really invigorating about that. Think, oh, that we can perhaps do this. There are transferable skills, but I'm learning new stuff all the time. And that really is exciting.
And ironically, being an innovator can be lonely.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%.
So moving on to about being an innovator. So being an innovator with a product being used in the NHS, that's really challenging. There's massive investment financially and time just to get to the point of, you know, getting your product to market. And you may not see a return on investment for years. Like you've mentioned, Simon, the grant landscape is challenging. So how have you managed this? And maybe to you, Dean, how have you managed that transaction from being a research organisation to a commercial organisation?
Well, I guess, as we were saying, there's quite a few transferable skills. I think the other thing is just to recognise you've just got to carve off time for this. It doesn't happen without putting a lot of effort in. So we've managed to carve out a bit of time, and the university has been really supportive. I think that's a key point. They recognise that innovation matters, and a university, if it's doing what it should be doing, it should be encouraging spin-out companies. It should be having this effect. So we've got some protected time to do that. And I think that's key, a recognition that this is part of what you should be doing as an academic. You should be having an impact in the real world. And part of doing that is to do stuff like we're doing now. So I think the university has backed us on that, and that helps us protect the time to spin lots of plates.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Simon, what challenges have you faced being an innovator? And a supplementary question, is there any moment where you've just gone, this is just too hard?
Most days of the week, it's just too hard. So one of the things that's really good about moving into innovation is it allows you to evolve. So deprogram yourself as an academic and speaking to different audiences, find a very clear and consistent message based on your research that people can understand. That's the big pivot that I've done. And the Propel program was great for that. So helping us not just think about what's the next research project that we're going to go for, but to think about what our value proposition is. So thinking about what the problem is and how what we've got and what we've built can solve that problem brings a lot of clarity of thought and a clarity of communication that sometimes we don't get in academia. So being able to create a consistent message and to communicate the importance of our research is the big pivot that I've made and the challenge. And, you know, sometimes you go and speak to people, you think you've had a great conversation, you don't get a follow-up call. And that's the challenge. And sometimes you think, you know, got to keep going, and you've got to keep going. But academia, I think, gives you a good training for that.
Yeah, we'll come on to the support you've received,
yeah,
especially the Propel program, shortly. So, Simon, if you could travel back in time, what advice would you give yourself with the knowledge you know now, being an innovator?
So, from the get-go, if you've invented something, always think about what the value of that will be to the people who are going to use it in the end, or more importantly, for the people who are going to make a financial case to support the rollout of what you do. We don't always do that in academia, but creating a value proposition. What's the problem and how are we going to solve that? What is the cost of the innovation that we've developed? But more importantly, what's the value of the innovation that we've created? So for us, thinking about loneliness, when we communicate with people who are decision makers in the NHS, we've got to think about what some of the pain points are for the NHS. And we don't always do that in academia. So, you know, for loneliness, it drives prolonged and frequent and unplanned admission to hospital. This is a big pain point for the NHS at the moment. So if we can find something that solves a particular problem, a particular financial problem for the NHS, and helps people move out of hospital and stay in their own homes, then that's really important. I'd encourage my younger self to think about prevention rather than cure as well. So I think we've got an innovation here that does help the NHS move on its journey from treatment to prevention. And that's a big priority for the NHS just at the moment. You'll hear our health secretary speak about that all the time. So, and we don't always do that in the NHS. So the NHS, it's got National Health Service in its title. Too often the NHS is busy firefighting for understandable reasons. So being able to help the NHS and ourselves as clinicians and my clinical colleagues to think not just about treatment, not just about treating the problem in front of you, but think about how you can prevent problems before they become entrenched and before they come started. That's a lesson I would probably give to my younger self. So let's think a bit more about prevention rather than treatment. I'm a psychiatrist as well, and a talking therapist, and I'd like to put myself and my colleagues out of business as well. I want to be the psychiatrist. Dean wants to be the psychologist that puts clinical psychologists and psychiatrists out of business.
One thing I'd add in terms of what advice I'd give to my younger self around, and this is, do it. I should have done it 10 years earlier. Yeah, I enjoyed this so much, and it really helps finish off that cycle of you have an idea, you do a piece of research, but then you get it out there into the real world. One bit of advice would, I should have done this 10, 15 years ago. And if you've got any doubts about going for it, go for it. It's just really interesting, really fascinating, and you learn a lot.
Yeah. It's interesting. We're sat on a couch and with a psychiatrist. I don't know whether to be scared or complimented on that.
We don't do that anymore.
We don't.
Yeah, we don't.
Dean, looking forward, what are you looking forward to with Third Age Therapeutics in 2026?
Well, we think we're in a position now, perhaps, to do a case study in the NHS, do a case study outside of the NHS, because this could work just as well as outside the NHS in other settings, demonstrating that what we can make work in on a research footing can work out there in the real world and really demonstrate that. That'll be the challenge for the next year. So I think we're going to be busy over the next year demonstrating that. But that'd be great to do, to demonstrate we can take it from research through into the real world.
Yeah, and those case studies and evaluation, they can be a driver for growth as well from an innovator's perspective. Yeah. Okay, back to Simon. So what advice would you give to early stage innovators? Dean's already mentioned, just go for it. So what advice would you give to early stage innovators?
It's important that you build the evidence base to support the value of your innovation. So we've been blessed by being able to draw upon a research program that goes back 30 years. Lots of innovators haven't got that. So if you're not someone who knows how to demonstrate that something works and demonstrate that it's good value for money, go and make friends very quickly with people who can help you do that. So it's great to have an innovation often born out of personal experience, or you've had a light bulb moment, but you've got to put the hard yards in to demonstrate that things work. So that you can't bypass that. It's just really important. And innovation isn't going to happen without some of that underpinning research to support what you do.
And I suppose one of the benefits is there's a lot of data, yep. NHS data, social data that's out there, so they can tap into that. Okay, moving on to the section about support from West Yorkshire. I coordinate an accelerator programme called Propel, which you was on as well. So you were on our accelerator programme, was it last year, the year before?
Yeah, we're class of 2024-25, yeah.
2024, yeah. How did this help you and Third Age Therapeutics?
Oh, it's been great. So Propel's a thing of beauty and a thing of wonder. Yorkshire, in particular West Yorkshire, is the centre of the known universe. So it's great that this happens here. And I was speaking to the converted, but there might be people out there that do not know how wonderful Yorkshire is. And the Propel programme sits at the centre of that. So we were introduced to it, and it's got quite a rigorous application process. So the first thing I would say about the Propel programme is, because they don't give it up easily, the actual application process helps sharpen your thinking, think about what you want to get out of it. So actually applying for the Propel programme, even if we'd not been successful, really did sharpen up our argument and help us think about how we could communicate what our vision was and what the value of our innovation was. So the application process was great. But once you get on, I mean, it's the three P's, isn't it? So it's people, it's partnerships, and it's the peers that you have there. So I don't know, you're a modest man, Tim, but you're great. So you bring it all together, and all the other brilliant people that oversee the Propel programme. And you're very well connected. So you're able to bring this cast of a number of organizations and innovators, bring them together and help us on that innovator journey. So the actual things that we learned on the Propel program were amazing. So these partnerships, you know, there are so many people out in the Yorkshire ecosystem, the innovation ecosystem. So the Propel program sort of curated that, so it ensured that we got good access to legal expertise, good access to digital builders and makers. We got really good access to the innovation landscape that exists in the NHS. So we could have done that anyway, but the Propel programme really made it happen. And the final piece, the peer support. So we're in a group of a dozen or so innovators and companies where everyone wants everyone else to succeed. So that peer support, the hive mind, the communal brain, and that general, you know, this is great, you know, don't be embarrassed, you can do things, let's work out how we can help each other. Peer support's amazing. So everyone wants everyone to succeed, and everyone's checked their egos when they come in. So I learned so much from the people that were also on the program.
The connections piece is really important for, I think, for innovators.
Yep.
Like we've mentioned, it can be quite an isolating thing to do, pressurised. And it's that learning across innovators I find exciting.
Yeah.
You know, you may have a problem that an innovator's resolved, so being in that area to discuss that's really, really useful. Dean, so are you aware of the West Yorkshire Mayor's Fund that you've been involved with?
Yes, we applied for that a while back, yeah, and we're working our way through to the finalist stage on that, which has been really interesting and learnt a lot doing that.
And Simon, how did you hear about the West Yorkshire Mayor's Big Ideas? How were you?
Well, it wasn't on my radar. And then one of the great things about Propel programme is they have lots of networking events. So I got in a conversation with you and you introduced me to someone else. You probably don't know this, Tim, but you introduced me to someone else who was applying for this thing called the West Yorkshire Mayor's Big Challenge. And so I thought, I went and looked it up, and the closing date was 2 weeks away. So I thought, well, you know, we could speak to that. So we're blessed here in West Yorkshire with an amazing mayor, so Tracy Brabin. She's got lots of energy and lots of vision, and she's bothered about inequalities, and she's bothered about the health of people within our communities. And she's particularly bothered, and she says this, and you know, she's put some resources in to support this, on the health and the mental health of our older population here in West Yorkshire. So this is what the West Yorkshire Innovation challenge was about. So see how we can leverage some of the expertise and the innovation that exists within a region to try and address the pressing inequalities that exist in the region. So tapping into the expertise, tapping into the innovation, but also thinking about how we can leverage that and be successful to create jobs in West Yorkshire as well. So it's that, you know, really helpful combination. You know, we're bothered about mental health of older people in the region, and loneliness isn't an equal opportunities thing. It disproportionately impacts on older people. It disproportionately impacts on disadvantaged communities. So it's a driver of inequalities. And we were in a good position to respond to the Mayor of West Yorkshire's challenge, and that was see how we can innovate to reduce health inequality. So here we are. We are finalists in that process, and we'll see how we get on, but it's been
find
great.
Out in a month or so.
You find out in a month.
And in about a month, yeah, whether I think there's 19 who got through to the stage we're through, and three will get a prize of £100,000 to take it to the next stage, and we're just about to find out whether we're one of those three. So we worked very hard over Christmas getting the finalist stage in. So we were sending texts to each other at 5 o'clock in the morning in the run-up to Christmas, which is, I guess, the other thing you have to recognise. If you want to do this, you've got to put in some hard yards sometimes.
Don't be a clock watcher. Yeah.
So 100K, if you win, fingers crossed, what would you spend that 100K on? How is it going to support your organisation?
Shall I go first? Well, Dean's a West Yorkshireman, so a Yorkshireman and his money are not EFC League parted. So, I mean, the first thing we'll do is, from our own pocket, we'll probably go and have a pint, and we will splash out on the Deluxe Tarly at Annan's Suites. We're both fans of the high-quality South Asian cuisine that we're blessed with here in West Yorkshire. So that's what we'll do first and foremost. And then we'll think, what are we going to do with this? So we want to road test our innovation, as you've spoken of, Tim. So having some case studies where you can see how our innovation aligns with the patient care journey in the NHS is going to be really important for us. And this will give us the resources to do that. So we've got some good potential partnerships teed up with the innovation pop-up here in Leeds, and also home care providers, and we'll be able to do that with the resources that might be freed up. And if we're not successful, we'll find other ways to do that. So it's facilitated lots of conversations. And we think we'll use the £100,000 to create some jobs here in West Yorkshire. We think that's the important part of the virtuous cycle of innovation, is that it's really good for our regional economies. So we want to do that. And it'll make us more investable as well. We're going to need investment in order to scale this. And that will just help us a little bit further along that journey.
Yeah. So in the last year, obviously, the investment zones supported not only just the Leeds ecosystem, we've got the Bradford, Huddersfield, and Wakefield corridor as well. So there's opportunities there to have conversations as well. So
we'll chat to you afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, final section. So this is about us as people. So it's quite, you know, we get busy with our day jobs, don't we?
Yeah, yeah.
So Dean, what is your weekend thing? What do you do outside work?
Well, the good thing about being an academic is you're allowed to be a nerd. So I'm allowed to be a professional nerd, and I'm very happy with my own nerd. So one of the things I'm interested in outside clinical psychology is architecture. So I spend a lot of my weekend trying to convince my family to go see obscure 1960s bits of brutalism or some 13th century church. I usually have to link it with some type of meal in the close to where it is. But that's a lot of my weekend, trying to get the kids out and have a look at this building. It's really important. So that's what I do.
That's a rabbit hole I could go down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just the architecture in Leeds. I mean,
Bradford's brilliant.
Bradford,
Leeds is brilliant.
York.
Yeah, Leeds. In fact, yeah, after today, I'll have a little wander around and see what
and
I can see.
And it's all different.
It's all different, and it's all free. It's an art gallery that you don't have to pay to get into.
When we take innovators to like Leeds Teaching Hospital Trust, they're in awe with like the old medical centre and the architecture.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
George Gilbert Scott, same guy that designed St Pancras Station.
Yeah, yeah. And you can tell.
Yeah, it's amazing. Same question to you, Simon. What's your weekend thing?
Great question. You didn't tell me this one was coming. So let me think. So Leeds, I'm a bit of a political nerd, so Leeds has some very colourful MPs down the years, and one of the most colourful MPs is someone that older people might remember, and that was Dennis Healy.
Oh,
he was the former Chancellor of Exchequer, and Dennis Higley was an interesting guy. So he was a politician, but he'd also been the beach commander at Anzio during the Second World War. And he was also a very accomplished photographer. So he always said, and I took notice of this at the time, it's really important for people to have an hinterland. So a hinterland, I think, is important. So, you know, I've got a busy job during the week. So my hinterland that is a bit like Dean's is we're here in West Yorkshire. I live in Leeds and I love Leeds and I've lived here for a few decades and I live in a particular part of Leeds that some people might know. So that's Leeds 6, so Hyde Park, Headingley. Hyde Park's got one of the oldest functioning Victorian cinemas anywhere in Britain and it's still got gas lights. Hyde Park Picture House is where I tend to hang out at the weekend. Yeah. They've got a brilliantly curated programme of films. And it's just a joy to sit in there. The council has made some investment. It's been refurbished and it's good to go for another 100 years. So that's where I tend to hang out if I want to do something different. And conveniently, it's only 20 yards away from the finest and also the cheapest eatery in West Yorkshire. So that is Anand Sweets, where you can get a tally that does the business for £6.50.
£6.50.
Yeah, recommend it.
So curry and a film.
That sounds really good. And the cinema you talk about, Simon, they'll play like old movies and they'll have themed events as well. And what's the, there's a venue in Hyde Park as well, the, I can't remember
Brudenell,
what it's called.
Is it? Brudenell.
Sport, Brudenell, yeah. Yes.
Great bands there.
Yeah.
Even ones that I'd recognise.
Well, it's interesting because you end up with the bands that maybe you was into 20 years ago. Yeah. Retouring and playing small niche gigs there.
Very much so.
Okay, so that's your questions. This section, you're allowed to ask me one question. And this is, I don't know what the question is, so let's go with yours, Dean.
Right, so here's my question. So, Propel Health Tech, this is all about, or mainly about, health tech in West Yorkshire, but you can tell from your accent that you're not from West Yorkshire. And we were chatting, you're from the East Riding of Yorkshire, so... tell some West Yorkshire people, our West Yorkshire viewers, what's a hidden gem in the East Riding of Yorkshire that you're not going to necessarily know about if you're from West Yorkshire?
Ooh. As you can tell, I've got a bit of a hybrid Yorkshire accent. So my parents came from Hull.
Yeah.
So I've got a Hull twang.
Uh-huh.
And then I was brought up in Bridlington on the East Yorkshire coast.
So great places.
Even between like...
Oh, there's a difference.
Driffield and Brid, there's different dialect.
Uh-huh.
And then I've been in Leeds for 20 years. So yeah, it's a proper Yorkshire hybrid. I think, so my brother and his wife went to Sperm Point.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which is a place that you wouldn't really think is a place that you'd go to because it's just like desolate.
So, yeah.
They had an amazing time. So I think it's the East Yorkshire coast.
Yeah.
Walking across the beach, on the beach, in summer's amazing, winter's just as good.
Yeah.
And I need to go down to Sperm Point because that's meant to be amazing as
well.
There
you go.
Yeah. But then also it's peppered with fine ale houses and there's one in Old Town in Bridlington called the Boarding.
Right.
It's really, really good.
So what's the Boarding?
Boarding is a pub.
A pub, right, okay.
Yeah, but it's got all the 18th century decor in it.
Oh, wow. Nice. Brilliant.
And you really feel like you've walked into the 1800s. So I'd recommend it.
And is that in the old town of Brid?
That's right, in the old town,
well,
yeah.
Next time I visit Brid.
Yeah, that's it's worth a trip to the old town. So they've had a bit of investment.
Right.
All worldy.
Yeah, yeah.
Really good on a dark winter's night sat in there. You really feel like... Dick Turpin's going to turn up at any moment and take everyone
Brilliant.
Up.
Two good recommendations, thank you.
Well, that's good. Well, I'll add one. There's Hull. It's got one of the finest pubs with the greatest name anywhere in the world. So it's got a record for having the smallest window, but also the coolest name. So the Land of Green Ginger, you know that one?
No. Yeah. I like the niche that it's got the smallest window.
It is the smallest window, yeah. It's about that's so big.
That's their claim to fame.
Yeah, it is.
And Simon, you're allowed to ask me a question.
Well, I don't know. Tim, you are the networking ninja. So whenever I turn up at a networking event, I sort of see faces, 98% of whom I don't recognise. And I still struggle a bit with low-level social anxiety and an imposter syndrome. So when I see a room of 200 people, I've got better at it. So I try to dive in and start a conversation. But if I'm struggling, I often see someone who rises above the crowd, and it's always going to be Tim East. So you are the best networker I know anywhere. So you are what is sometimes termed a hyper networker. So tell me what your top tips are for networking, Tim, because I think it's a really important transferable skill and I've learned a lot from you.
Oh, that's kind, Simon. I think it's that thing where it does take a step to do an introduction.
Yeah.
And it's having the mindset that the other person's just probably as nervous and about it. And we're all people. Uh-huh. And actually what I've realised is, as humans, we're so sociable. Mm-hmm. We just need that step first to do step. That introduction.
Yeah.
You know, so...
That's great. That ties up really well with our research. So we are deeply programmed to be social animals. Mm. It's an evolutionary thing that comes from our evolved past. And, you know, if you can be sociable, you've got a better chance of surviving and then passing on your genes. So it confers an evolutionary advantage. So when you mess with that, you get loneliness, then
And also I think things like conferences, it's like, you'll know, being an innovator, it's joining up those dots. Do you know what I mean? The amount of times I'll be speaking to an innovator and they'll say, oh, I'm struggling with whatever. And I'm like, I just scan like, oh, they need to speak to that person. Guess you would probably get it in your academic work or clinical work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's joining those dots. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for answering the question.
I'd like to thank our guests, Dean and Simon from Third Age Therapeutics. Thanks for your insight into health tech innovation and supporting patients with technology. In the next edition of the Propel podcast, we will be joined by Olivia Burns, who manages the Propel Startup Programme, is also an innovator with a product sold into the NHS and overseas, as well as Jude Gordon, who leads on the Propel Scale-Up Programme, was a GP and a clinical lead for a health tech company. We will be shining a spotlight on the challenges and rewards of being a startup company and giving insight into how we can propel scale-ups to bring value to the NHS and patients. So until next time, thanks a lot.